it's a last resort. There's room in a shelter. We know, as a matter of fact, that that's true. And it's worse to see a camp grow up that's going to result in, in unsanitary, dangerous, really predatory situations for these folks.
That's Boise, Idaho Mayor Dave Beter speaking to the public radio show Idaho Matters in August. Well, this morning he received a setback. The Supreme Court let stand without comment a lower court ruling that protects the right of homeless people to sleep on sidewalks or in parks. Homeless advocates argue it's cruel to punish people who have nowhere else to sleep at night. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed. But many city officials, like in Iowa and in California, say the ruling hinders their ability to regulate homeless encampments on city streets. Well, joining us now to talk about how L.A. will respond to the Supreme Court non-decision are L.A. City Council members Mike Bonin and Bob Blumenfield. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Well, Councilman Bonin, I want to get your thoughts first. You represent parts of the West Side, and what is your reaction to what the Supreme Court did today?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to note I actually did not support the city attorney filing an amicus brief to agree with Boise and ask the court to intervene, and did not support the county's effort to do so as well, because I thought it would continue to put us on a track of a failed policy of criminalization and distract us from the real mission. And I think that it's really important today for no one to treat the Supreme Court's non-decision as an endorsement or an acceptance in any way of sidewalk encampments. And sidewalk encampments are unacceptable. What we need to do is treat this thing as a firm and an indisputable mandate for more housing, for more shelter, and for more and better services.
And Councilman Blumenfield, what is your reaction?
Well, I certainly agree with Mr. Bonin about the need, the mandate for more housing and more services. I was disappointed, however, and I did agree with our city attorney to file the amicus brief, because I found that the Boise decision was both ambiguous and internally inconsistent. And without having the Supreme Court come in, it leaves us open to continued lawsuits. And it leaves us in a very vulnerable position where we don't have the ability that we need to balance the legitimate rights of the homeless population with the legitimate rights of our local residents and businesses.
What would you like to be able to do? What do you want the legal authority to be able to do when it comes to homeless encampments?
Well, at the very least, we need to have more control over time, place, and manner. You know, we cannot criminalize the homeless, but at the same time, we cannot allow folks to sleep on any and every street corner at any time. That creates incredible burdens for the city, and it creates safety issues as well. I mean, there are certain locations, certainly in my district, I think of locations by schools that end up blocked and kids end up walking into the street because their access is not clear. And they're just, to me, it's common sense that we need to have certain locations that we have control over as a city, and that creating a de facto constitutional right to live on sidewalks and parks at any and all times is not acceptable.
Councilman Bonin, what's wrong with that, Councilman Bonin? That does sound like common sense.
So I agree with Bob's diagnosis of some of the problem. I have it probably even to a greater degree in my district than in his. I mean, we have a very large homeless population in Venice and in Mar Vista and parts of my district. But there's a difference between the encampments, the belongings. That's an entirely separate matter. And this decision, which was about sitting, lying, and sleeping. And what I have seen over my past 7 years in office and a decade before that in City Hall is that when we have the tools to try to legislate homelessness away or enforce homelessness away, it becomes the primary focus. And it doesn't work. I mean, it sort of locks people into a cycle of citation and fine and jail time and homelessness. And it distracts us from what I really think the city's main mission should be right now, is finding quicker and faster ways to get people off the streets. because the city and the county, we're getting 133 people off the street every day, but 150 are becoming homeless every day. So we got to get faster about getting people off and work on prevention strategies.
And what is the primary roadblock to providing quicker and faster ways of getting people off the streets?
Well, my diagnosis would be that both the bureaucracy and sort of the social service system are primarily focused on one single solution, permanent supportive housing, which is the right solution for 20 or 30% of the homeless population, but not for 70%. And we need faster solutions that the bureaucracy just sort of isn't open-minded to. And that's things like shared housing, where people share a room. It's things like master leasing, where the government rents a bunch of units and we can put people in them quickly. And it's rapid rehousing vouchers, which is basically a short-term rental subsidy for people who are not chronically homeless, just need a little leg up for a short period of time, help them with the rent for 6 months and put them in one of the city's mandated affordable units from a development, and then they're good to go.
What about creating more shelters, emergency shelters?
Well, my feeling is we need to be doing everything. You know, so we're building bridge housing. We just got a very good decision the other day from the courts that's letting us open the bridge housing, which is a transitional shelter in Venice. Should be open in a few weeks, as should ours at the VA. We need to be doing all of it, and we can't focus on just one thing because there's no magic wand. There's no silver bullet. And just as there's different types of homelessness, there needs to be different solutions and models to get people out of homelessness.
And Councilman Blumenfield, do you agree with some of those solutions that your colleague has put forward?
I do. And in fact, I mean, we've been working together on a number of those, shared housing, you know, chief among them. And we've got to have more and better ways to get people into housing and get them into housing cheaper and faster. But that doesn't negate the fact that we also need to deal with drug addiction, we need to deal with mental health, and we need to have a balance in terms of being able to enforce some of the laws on the streets as well as providing the services and the housing. It is a balancing act, but I am 110% with Mr. Bonin on getting the extra services, getting the housing, doing it faster and cheaper. More creatively, we need to be doing the shared housing and finding ways to get large numbers of people to offer them those services. But there are folks out there who are denying services, and we need to make sure that we have the tools to deal with them as well, and that we have the incentives to get people into rehabilitation and drug addiction and mental health programs that have been, you know, cut over these years, and is a critical piece to this puzzle as well.
But all of that does take time. It takes time to develop programs. It takes time to develop places to live. It takes years, in fact. Right now, there are homeless encampments sprouting up all over the place. There's an emergency citywide. What do you propose to do in the short term?
Well, the short term, we talked about some of the bridge housing. We're putting one up in my district. I know we're trying to put them up all over. That's an immediate thing to get people directly off the street. But back to the Boise case and how that's related is that if you want communities to accept these bridge homes and these short-term solutions, and which are critically important, and I think we all agree that the bridge home is important, if you don't have the ability as a city to do some extra patrol to enforce laws around that bridge housing, going to be very difficult to get the community to accept that bridge housing in their area. Whereas if you can say, hey, we're bringing in bridge housing to bring people off the street, but we're going to make sure that we enforce the laws, with regard to loitering and sleeping in a proximity to that bridge housing, you're going to get more people willing to accept with open arms those kind of bridge housing functions. And without those tools, it makes it difficult to implement some of these short-term solutions.
Now, Councilman,
it's very difficult to do that if you don't have the tools.
Councilman Bonin, you have had firsthand experience with a lot of NIMBYism in your district when it comes to this. What do you say to residents who don't want that to happen? They don't want people loitering around these bridge housing complexes.
Well, first of all, I wouldn't label it as NIMBYism. I think people have genuine frustration with encampments in front of their kid's school. I mean, nobody should be living and dying in an encampment. I think we all agree on that. What my perspective is, is that attempts to sort of force people into services through punitive measures has not worked. It hasn't worked in Los Angeles. It hasn't worked elsewhere. And what we have to do is do more to incentivize people by providing better services and providing more housing. So to the extent that there has been pushback against housing and shelter, I think it's important to remind people that the alternative to encampments is housing and shelter. And housing is cleaner than encampments. Housing is healthier than encampments. Housing is safer than encampments. And providing housing is actually less expensive to the city and to the county and to the taxpayer than it is to be dealing with encampments all around the city. I think if we want to find better ways to get the relatively small service-resistant population, to use a term I think is overused, into the services we provide, I think we need to actually be, and this is something I've called for, having a commission of people who are homeless or formerly homeless to tell us how our programs are actually working and why the ones that are not working are failing.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. We'll talk about this more, of course, in the future. LA City Council members Mike Bonin, Bob Blumenfield, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much.
Other Supreme Court action. The court has agreed to take up a major case about President Trump's tax returns at issue, whether the president can block Congress and state prosecutors from getting those financial records. It sets up what's likely to be a landmark ruling on the powers of the presidency and a test of the court's independence. It's Monday, so that means one thing. The Legal Eagle is in the house. Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Hey.
That's the only thing Monday means.
It's the only thing it means to me. The best thing about Monday. Okay, so three subpoenas at the heart of this case, two from Congress, one from the Manhattan DA. What are they about?
So they're all about somewhat similar but different things. Essentially, they're asking for information regarding, for instance, the hush money payments that were made to Stormy Daniels and to Karen McDougal to not talk about the fact that they allegedly had affairs with President Trump. They're also asking for information regarding whether or not there was any money laundering related to Russian interference with the presidential elections. So there's, again, this one request by Cyrus Vance, the New York District Attorney. Essentially, he's trying to execute a subpoena that came from a grand jury saying, we want this financial information from you. And then there's two cases dealing with congressional committees who are saying, we want various types of financial information from you, President Trump, because we're looking at things like whether or not you might have committed banking or tax fraud, whether or not we need new ethics rules in place. And so we need that information to make those determinations.
So these are all separate cases, but they're all rolled up into one decision, possibly?
Possibly. So I actually think that there's a decent chance that the court will take these kind of piece by piece and that we might see a patchwork decision, in part because it's going to be hard to get consensus, I think, on these cases, and in part because they actually do raise somewhat different questions. So the New York case obviously deals with state criminal proceedings. Mm-hmm. That's a little bit different from congressional oversight, which brings up separation of powers issues.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So in the New York case, they're seeking, I think Cyrus Vance is seeking 8 years of business and personal tax records. So a lot of information. Is the Trump administration arguing, well, you can't get this information now because he's the president?
They are. They're making this really broad argument that the sitting president of the United States is always constitutionally immune from not just being, let's say, indicted by federal prosecutors or state prosecutors, but investigated. And so the judge in these oral arguments said to President Trump's representative, essentially, do you mean that if the president shoots someone in the middle of New York, we can't investigate? And he said, right, they're constitutionally immune. And that really did draw breaths in the oral argument. Hmm. And this is one of these cases where you have to think, not do you want President Trump to be able to claim this constitutional immunity, but do you want every other president to say, not that you can't indict me, but you can't even look into me. And I think that this is the case where we might see actually more consensus by the Supreme Court. We could see something closer to an 8-1 decision, let's say, whereas for the congressional cases that this overarching case brings up, I think you could see more division.
And it's worth noting that the lower courts have sided with Vance in this case and with Congress.
So for all of the three separate decisions, the lower court, the federal district judges, and then the Court of Appeals have all sided with either the prosecutors or Congress. So President Trump has lost repeatedly in every one of these cases. But we've seen this happen before. We saw it, for instance, with respect to the travel ban. We saw it a little bit with respect to the census. That was a difficult decision by the Supreme Court, but where there's universal losses on the lower court level, and then something different happens on the Supreme Court.
So what about the other two, the House Oversight and House Financial Services and Intelligence Committees? They're the ones who are asking for these other records to possibly look into possible money laundering. What is the argument there?
So
from the Trump administration.
So the argument from the Trump administration is essentially you don't have a legitimate legislative purpose for asking for this.
It's like a fishing expedition.
Right. You're just on a partisan witch hunt. So if there's pending legislation and you want to try and get information for that legislation, then OK. But if you're just casting about trying to essentially throw dispersions on the sitting president, then that's not OK. Now, it's important to actually remember when we talk about congressional oversight, one, it's not actually something that's in the Constitution. We just understand that it's a constitutional power. But also, Congress has actually broad authority. So they don't have to just say there's legislation pending. Congress also, for instance, has the power of the purse. So if they're being asked to appropriate money, they can look into whether or not that's a good decision to appropriate that money. So arguably, the president saying you don't have a good legislative purpose is maybe even a bit too narrow of an argument.
Of course, this is all coming down against the backdrop of impeachment. And so how is that figuring into the Supreme Court's, I don't know, not necessarily its decision, because the decision isn't expected till June, but its calculation when it hears these arguments?
Well, so those are two totally separate tracks. And I tried to talk to my students about this in the sense that what's happening in the courts is, in fact, different from what's happening in the House or what's happening in the Senate chambers. Now, of course, it's not totally separate in the sense that impeachment is it's the ultimate congressional oversight. So impeachment is Congress looking at the president of the United States. But for impeachment, we know Congress has a good reason. They don't need a legitimate legislative purpose for impeachment. It's in the Constitution. It says Congress has the sole power to impeach the president. And so, yes, it's all overlapping because it deals with essentially President Trump and whether or not he engaged in problematic behavior. But it's separate because the impeachment is very narrowly just on this issue of what happened with respect to President Trump and President Zelensky of the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Okay, quickly, another story in the news, Wisconsin purging more than 200,000 people from its voter list. This is important because obviously a swing state and President Trump barely won this by something like 20,000 votes last time around.
So this is how you win elections. So you win elections not by necessarily who you nominate to be your party's nominee, but you win elections by these things, by changing, for instance, where you vote, by throwing people off voter rolls, by redrawing district lines. And so what's happening in Wisconsin is the state elected officials essentially sent postcards to people and said, if you still live there, respond and say you still live in this place, and then we'll keep you on the voter rolls. A lot of people didn't respond. And so what happened is the state election officials were going to essentially in April of 2020, sometime around there, kind of get on the business of culling their voting rolls. Conservative group sued and said, no, you need to, if people didn't respond, you need to take them off the voter rolls now. Now, why is it a conservative group? Because it tends to be overwhelmingly that Democratic voters aren't as good at returning these particular types of postcards, and that they're sent to people in areas that are more urban, where people are moving around more, where there's more students.
Well, could you argue the students did graduate and move out of state, and they should be purged?
Exactly. But if you look at where these notices were sent, why they were sent, for instance, it could be people who registered a vehicle at a business address, and then all of a sudden it keys to the system that maybe they don't live where they say they live anymore. It's not necessarily just students who are graduating.
But there will be an appeal of this decision.
Yes.
Okay. Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Instagram made the cheap clothing company Fashion Nova hip. Rappers like Cardi B have collabs, but the LA factories where the clothes are made pay workers less than minimum wage in some cases, and in some cases, a lot less. That story next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Kylie Jenner, Cardi B, Amber Rose all have been paid promoters for the fashion brand Fashion Nova. It's a fast fashion company. It's based here in LA. They make $30 booty lifting jeans, neon orange bicycle shorts, metallic puffer jackets, snakeskin bodysuits. Well, the Labor Department says the factories making Fashion Nova's clothing, also in the LA area, are paying illegally low wages in certain circumstances. Some workers are paid less than $3 an hour. Joining me now is Natalie Kitroeff. She wrote about this for the New York Times. Welcome.
Hi.
Well, give us a little backstory on Fashion Nova. When did they come onto the scene?
Fashion Nova has been around for a while. The first brick-and-mortar store opened in 2006, founded by a guy named Richard Sagian, who, you know, realized quickly that he was getting beaten by online outlets. And so he didn't open a website, he opened an Instagram, and that is really where this story begins. Fashion Nova has come out of seemingly nowhere in recent years and used Instagram influencers, celebrities, micro-influencers to spread the word about its cheap and mass-produced clothes. So this is a company that is offering new options every single week, 1,000 styles every week, and it's satisfying a very online clientele that has really eaten them up. You know, they, as you said, they are associated with Cardi B, Kylie Jenner. You've seen this company go from the outskirts of the internet into firmly into the mainstream.
So they're kind of like Forever 21 on steroids.
Actually, one of my sources, a former Labor Department official, called them Zara on steroids.
Oh.
So you're right on the money there. It is seen as a juggernaut, an e-commerce juggernaut, and one that, again, is built around a customer base that is on the internet. The founder told me, you know, he knows what his customers want, and it's to post themselves wearing hot new outfits every day, if possible.
And the outfits are pretty, well, for lack of a better word, body conscious, revealing, sexy.
The brand has had a lot of success, you know, making clothes that, you know, fit women of all different shapes and sizes. There's a lot of body positivity with the brand. And yes, these are, you know, often tight, stretchy, you know, shimmery material. It's not the Kohl's crowd. It is definitely for a young and image conscious group of customers.
Who don't want to pay a lot.
Right. Well, his idea, the founder's idea, Richard Sagian, is you are giving people the ability to buy frequently. And how do you do that? You have to give them very low prices so they keep coming back. And so they are able to afford to consume a lot of this brand's offerings.
And Cardi B made a collection with them and the items sold out within hours.
That's right. She announced her collection on Instagram. It sold out within 4 hours.
Wow.
You know, this was just sell. I mean, she has another collection with them. And so, you know, this is a company that I don't know that everybody and their mother has heard of them, but they are extremely popular. In 2017, their sales increased 600%. You know, they've seen a lot of success with this model.
And part of the reason is their low bottom line, I suppose. So you delved into that, and several workers have complained and won settlements. What are the working conditions like at the factories here in LA that sew these garments?
Well, so the way that this works is that Fashion Nova and brands like Fashion Nova do not deal directly with factories. They deal with middlemen. They deal with these companies that produce samples for them. They buy a bulk order of samples, and those middlemen then go to the factories and get those clothes made. What I found in this investigation is that often when those factories are in LA, they are underpaying workers, you know, egregiously underpaying workers. We're talking below $3 an hour. And what you're seeing is factories in Los Angeles that often employ undocumented workers who are unlikely to complain, although, as you said, many have taken legal action at this point. And they are paying them by the piece. So these workers aren't really technically paid by hour. They're paid per item. They're paid for each thing that they do to the garment. And they're paid cents for each of those actions. And so at the end of the day, you know, after an 11-hour day, you know, someone will earn $60 an hour, $40 an hour. The Labor Department, in 50 investigations conducted between 2016 and 2019, found that Fashion Nova clothes were being made in factories that ultimately owed their workers $3.8 million in back wages.
Wow. And so how are they going to pay that back?
Well, so Fashion Nova is actually not on the line for that. And to be clear, those factories were making other clothes, so this isn't all Fashion Nova-related back wages. But legally, retailers like Fashion Nova cannot be fined or really held accountable for wage theft in their factories because, one, they don't employ the workers, and, two, often they can credibly claim that they didn't know that the workers were being underpaid to make these garments. Now, that question of whether they can credibly claim to not know, that is shifting because in September, the Labor Department did meet with Fashion Nova's lawyers and informed them of the extent of this problem. And those lawyers said, you know, they were taking immediate action to deal with this.
And what did that action entail?
They had already updated their agreement with vendors. And so now, under the new agreement, if one of those middlemen that I described, if there is legal action taken against a factory that that middleman worked with for labor violations, basically underpaying the minimum wage, then Fashion Nova puts the middleman on a probation. Fashion Nova will continue to work with that middleman unless, within a six-month period of that probation, another worker files another claim against either the same factory or a different factory that that middleman was working with. At that point, Fashion Nova suspends the middleman and requires that they submit and pass a third-party audit.
Sounds very complicated and lengthy, this process.
It is. It's a mouthful. I mean, I think, what you're seeing is a step toward trying to find a way to hold these companies accountable. I think part of the reason why you're noticing that it's complicated is that this supply chain is complicated, right? It's not as if Fashion Nova is going into the factories where its clothes are being made. They have, they're a step removed. And so the action that they're taking relates to the company that they are directly doing business with. I'd also say that, the reality is that Los Angeles is filled with garment factories that underpay their workers. This has been a persistent problem in LA for years. And, you know, the steps that are needed to address it, I think, go way beyond just one company. But, you know, you're seeing the Labor Department start to make some headway, I think, when they have what was described to me as a productive meeting with this retailer. We have no idea how much things will change, but this is a problem that all of us, you know, especially those of us who live in LA, I don't live in LA anymore, but your listeners, you know, you walk down the streets in downtown LA and you may not know that you are walking next to a factory where the Labor Department has recently found massive and illegal underpayment of wages. These factories are just, you know, everywhere in downtown Los Angeles. And that points to the fact that this is a problem that is really right under our nose.
Mm, yeah. And we're buying the clothes after all.
That's true. I mean, there are plenty
maybe
of
not you and me, but
there are plenty of brands that have been implicated in Labor Department investigations of underpayment of wages. TJ Maxx, Forever 21, Ross stores. So I think you know you're right. There is a piece of this that's consumer driven as well.
Well, Natalie, thank you for your reporting. Fascinating story.
Thanks for having me.
Natalie Kitcheroff, business reporter for The New York Times. Coming up, a 75-foot wave developed off the coast in Northern California recently. What it washed ashore is simultaneously fascinating and disgusting. Worms that look like, well, like a part of the male anatomy. Plus, Joe Pesci is getting a lot of raves for his performance in the Scorsese film The Irishman. He's getting mixed reviews for the new jazz album he just put out.
Although I read an AF review that says it sounds somewhere between Krusty the Clown and Macy Gray gone wrong. I disagree.
Joe Pesci's long musical career coming up on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It sounds like a cheesy sci-fi movie. A giant wave causes thousands of alien-like creatures to wash ashore. Well, that's what happened last month in Northern California. Some beaches there were ankle-deep in thousands of fat, pinkish worms. These worms go by several names. Fat innkeeper is one, and the penis fish is another. We'll spare you a more detailed description, but let's just say the nickname is well-earned. Marine biologist Pat Krug joins me now to talk about this. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
How are you?
Oh, I'm so glad we get to end the year in ocean science by talking about the great penis fish catastrophe of 2019.
Catastrophe, but for you and your ilk, you scientists, it was probably more like, you know, a Christmas present early.
I mean, that might be overstating the case.
Okay, well, describe how they got there on these beaches.
We drilled too deep and the worms got angry. No, it was a storm. It's always a storm. we had some really intense storm waves back around Thanksgiving. Uh-huh. And these are animals that live, I mean, don't live in a sandcastle. They live in sand tunnels in very shallow water, and the waves eroded the top couple feet of sand. And unfortunately for them, that meant that they lost their homes and they got washed ashore in the aftermath of those storms.
Right. And so people normally don't get to look at these things.
So there have been two previous big beaching events in 2010 and 2016 that were associated with El Nino events, which is also when we tend to get really heavy winter storm surge. And so this has happened, but I've never seen pictures like what was coming out of Northern California in the last few days.
It is pretty shocking. You need to go online to really see it, to believe it. The worm's actual name is the fat innkeeper, which sounds kind of jolly.
It's evocative. Yeah.
Well, how did it earn that name?
A couple of ways. So there are about 25,000 different species of marine worms. And this one little group, for a long time, scientists had put them in their own phylum. And like the vertebrates are not even their own phylum, like fish, reptiles, birds, and mammals. That's not a phylum. But these one little group of worms, people thought they were their own phylum because they're so different from all the other worms. And if you look at them, you can almost see why. If you think of an earthworm, they have segments, like they look like a chain of bricks, and these worms don't. They look like a water balloon. And that's fundamental to how they do what they do. They make these U-shaped tunnels, and then they make a big bulge in their body, like squeezing a water balloon, and that bulge travels down their body. And they use that bulge to push water through their tube. And as they do that, the water current pulls food particles into their tunnel. And then they blow a little snot bubble that traps food particles, and they eat their snot bubble. And that's their life. Not glamorous, but it works for them and for their friends. And so their tunnels become this nice little habitat, right? Because predators can't get into the tunnel, and it's got this current of nice oxygenated water that brings food in. And so they have a bunch of freeloading roommates that live in their tunnels. And so there's like a clam and a shrimp and a crab and a goby fish and some other worms, and they all hang out peacefully in the fat innkeeper's tunnel. So he's the innkeeper because he kind of manages this little hotel of all these wacky roommates.
Oh, it's so nice of him, actually.
Right?
He's providing a tiny little ecosystem.
Exactly.
So what happens when that ecosystem is blown apart by a massive wave and they're stranded, they're beached?
No one has any idea. We don't study these animals. I mean, it's like everything else. They're in, you know, a foot of water, and nobody really studies what happens when we lose tens of thousands of these animals in one fell swoop. So how fast do they recover? What does it do to the ecosystem? It's a big question mark because we don't really have survey data that I know of, and I don't really think that people have studied the population dynamics of these animals. So open question.
Yeah. Well, what about this wave? Does that signal anything to you in terms of, you know, crazy climate change, anything like that?
I mean, I think there's always a suggestion that these are anomalous events when they happen because they catch us off guard. It's probably the case that things like this have happened before, but it's a little different when you have the rapid dissemination by cell phone videos and the internet where you can actually see these events and where we have the fast sharing of information. So it hits you harder because you can actually see it. So I don't know. I don't know how extreme this is and whether it's a sign of a rapidly changing ocean. And I don't know if the community will have a harder time recovering, but I think it's certainly something that's worth studying.
Definitely. Does anyone eat this innkeeper?
Oh, what a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I do think people prey on them. I think that, I use them in my classes, and I can't really imagine eating them. But if you're a worm and you live in the ocean, you are literally bait. So all kinds of organisms eat these. Seagulls were feasting on these snowdrifts of worms that washed up on the beach. So anything that lives in the ocean would definitely love to eat these worms. And I think people do eat them, but not super appetizing, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, I don't think they look good on the plate.
No, I mean, you would need some little,
you need a hot dog bun for one. You would definitely need a hot dog bun. Okay, Pat Krug, marine biologist at Cal State LA. Always great to talk with you.
Thank you, Madeline. Never a dull moment.
Coming up, Joe Pesci's new jazz album. Yes, he's not just an actor. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Be a good little fella now and open the door.
Shoot!
What? What happened?
Get that little...
Joe Pesci, the actor, in Home Alone. But when Joe Pesci is not starring in holiday classics and Martin Scorsese gangster flicks, he is in the recording studio working on his jazz career.
Then she would stop and say hello, and I would try to let her know that I was wrong.
Pesci has been making music for about 50 years. He's 76 years old now. And last month, he released a new record. It's called Still Singing. And the critics seem to like it. Here to tell me more about Joe Pesci, the jazz singer, is Dom Nero, writer for Esquire. Hi.
Hey, Madeline.
Well, this new album, Still Singing, came out pretty recently, right around the time his new movie, The Irishman, came out. What does he do on this record?
So on Still Singing, Joe Pesci is back as a jazz singer. He's released a few albums before, and he originally retired from acting in the late 90s. And now on this new album, he seems like back full force in his singing career.
Yeah, so this movie, The Irishman, this was his first return in quite a long time, right, to the screen?
Yeah, he's been away from acting for a pretty long time. He's had a few cameo performances. I think he retired in 1999 formally, but since then he's showed up in a few films. But this is really his major return to acting.
Right, and maybe his major return to singing on this album.
Seems like it.
Okay, it's full of celebrity cameos, this album. Let's hear a bit of the song, Baby Girl. It features Maroon 5's Adam Levine, of all people, and trumpet player Arturo Sandoval.
I want so much to be the only love you see. I bet each time I try to look good in your eyes. Don't know if I'll get through it, being destroyed by you. And while you're collected and cool, I make a fool of myself.
So that's pretty good, actually. I don't know why I sound so surprised. I guess because I am. But his voice is nice there. He really hits the high note there.
Yeah, I think it's quite good. Although I read a review in The Independent that says it sounds somewhere between Krusty the Clown and Macy Gray gone wrong. I disagree.
So not all the critics love it, I guess.
Yeah.
Has his voice changed much since his first album?
Not really. I mean, the first time we hear him sing is on this album called Little Joe Sure Can Sing. That was in the late 60s. And it's an album of covers, sort of like a doo-wop thing. But his voice is, it sounds like his speaking voice in the films that we've come to know and love.
Yeah, the kind of like high-pitched, wise guy kind of voice.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's play a Christmas tune he did with his longtime collaborator, Frank Vincent. I think this is a parody, maybe a Porky Pig parody. It's called Can You Fix the Way I Talk for Christmas?
Come on, speak up loud and clear. Don't be nervous.
I eat a pig, yes, I could eat a use, able be a bat, and able be a ball. And maybe you could make me grow up if you at all. Some able be a brand new if you at all. And another thing.
All right. So, what's happening there?
Well, so Frank Vincent and Joe Pesci were a comedy duo before either of them became movie stars. Mm. I mean, you may remember Frank Vincent. He appeared in Raging Bull. That was Pesci's first major film. Mm-hmm. And then he later appeared in Goodfellas as Billy Batts. And then more significantly, he played Phil Leotardo in The Sopranos.
Yeah.
You know, the guy who gets his head cracked in the end.
He's the guy with the big head of hair, right?
Yeah, big white hair.
Yeah.
The two of them have been physically beating each other up in film for several decades. But prior to that, they were a comedy duo, sort of like Martin and Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a single they released in 1972 that I assume is part of their comedy routine. What I really like about it is it shows that Joe Pesci, you know, he doesn't take himself too seriously. You got to admire any artist who's able to, you know, look at himself in the mirror like this.
Right. And then he plays off his persona in his music, especially with the one called Vincent LaGuardia Gambini Sings Just For You. So that's his character in My Cousin Vinny. What's the story with that record?
Right. So in the 80s and 90s, after Pesci earned himself a supporting actor nomination for Raging Bull, he kind of blew up on the scene and kind of carved out his own part of Hollywood. I mean, as an actor, he sort of reflects earlier, like 1930s and 40s character actors like James Cagney and stuff. Mm-hmm. So by the end of the 90s, he was on top. I mean, My Cousin Vinny came out. It was a huge success. And this album was released right around the time of My Cousin Vinny. And it was it was him in character as My Cousin Vinny doing like big band and like lounge music I describe it in my article in Esquire as a cocaine Dean Martin.
Cocaine Dean Martin.
Yes.
All right, let's hear a little bit of it. This one's called Take Your Love and Shove It.
I've got all the yelling and the fights that we had. It won't be because of you. Hey, you moan and you groan and you f***ing and you whine. You make every beef we got last. Well, I'm telling you, baby, I'm through with you. Take your love, shove it up your big fat ass. Hey, I'm better off being all by myself like f***ing Celine Dion.
Okay, so Celine Dion. All right.
I'm from Jersey, too, and, you know, Pesci grew up in New York, and I was with my parents this weekend, and we were listening to this album together, and it's just so obscene.
I
mean,
it is.
It's not so culturally sensitive as it should be today, but the whole thing is just so filthy. There's a really good Christmas song on there where he berates a group of children, which is just like, it's so funny.
Okay, that's Vincent LaGuardia Gambini sings just for you. Tell us more about his Jersey roots, because you mentioned he's from Newark. So how did he become a jazz singer in New Jersey? What was the scene like?
Well, so yeah, he was born in Newark to like working class family. He was raised in Belleville, New Jersey. And from what I've read, it seems that his father was really keen on the kids becoming performers in show business. And his father, you know, had three jobs to pay for Pesci's acting and tap dancing and singing and guitar lessons. So Pesci was a child actor, which I don't think most people know. I mean, by the age of five, he was on TV on this show called Star Time Kids. And he never finished high school. He kind of just got into performance right away. And he was singing in nightclubs and playing guitar in this group called Joey D and the Starlighters.
Mm-hmm.
After playing in that group, he went on to, like I said before, he got in this nightclub comedy duo with that guy Frank Vincent. The two started doing the nightclub circuit together as I said, a kind of Martin and Lewis thing. And then he started showing up in little indie films, one of which Robert De Niro happened to see, and he noticed Joe Pesci and really, you know, plucked him out of obscurity. And Pesci, in his first major film, earned a supporting actor nomination, which he would later win for Goodfellas. But to have your first major film get an Oscar nomination for it, I think it's a pretty big deal.
Yeah. So if it weren't for Robert De Niro plucking him from obscurity, Pesci would have just continued being a local New Jersey jazz guy?
I guess so. It's interesting because he was really in the scene. I mean, he was friends with Tommy DeVito, who is one of the Four Seasons. And he's credited with introducing Frankie Valli and Tommy DeVito to Bob Gaudio. He was the producer who wrote the song Short Shorts. And then when he joined the Four Seasons, he wrote many of their most famous hits. As much as Pesci has meant to film, he did play a fairly large role in music, too.
And I guess it was a big Italian-American scene, the jazz scene in New Jersey.
Yeah, it seems like it. Most of the folks I just mentioned are all Italian-Americans. I think Italian-Americans take a lot of pride in Joe Pesci. I'm Italian-American from Jersey, so I feel like I can say that. I mean, he sort of represents us on screen.
Wait,
in the
do you want him to represent you on screen? Because he's not a lovable character in most of his roles.
I know a lot of, you know, first and second generation Italians in America are not too happy about movies like Goodfellas and The Godfather and, you know, the characters Pesci has played. But in my opinion, whenever you see Pesci in a film, he's always playing this sort of insecure character who is his own worst enemy. And the violence that he, you know, portrays on film is never really encouraged, especially in Scorsese films. So it's not as if he's saying that all Italian Americans are these violent psychopaths. I think he's more representing a larger theme about masculinity.
So who do you prefer, Joe Pesci the actor or Joe Pesci the jazz singer?
I'm going to have to go with the actor.
Okay. Dom Nero wrote about Joe Pesci's jazz career for Esquire. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
When I'm away from you, I know what to say and do. But every time you're near, my courage disappears. Don't know if I'll get through.
think, Michelle Alloy?
I'm also going to go with Joe Pesci, the actor. but I have to say, I did start going down his discography, and I discovered a Christmas song that he has, If It Doesn't Snow This Christmas, that is very adult-themed, but hilarious.
Snow?
Yeah, well, not that adult. Get your mind out of Doug's Bay over there.
You know. He does play mobsters.
He does play mobsters, yes. Apparently, fun story, he couldn't stop swearing filming Home Alone, so they took like a million takes of all those scenes.
Because he wasn't used to filming kids.
I know,
kids
didn't
fair.
Do kids' movies. National treasure, Joe Pesci.
Joe Pesci, fantastic. Thank you, Michelle Alloy. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.